I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush emerged from a rare visit to the Pentagon this morning, saying Donald Rumsfeld has done a superb job. This as more pictures of Iraqi prisoners being abused by American soldiers are surfacing. One photo described by journalist Seymour Hersh in this week's issue of The New Yorker apparently shows a naked prisoner being pinned down by a U.S. soldier as blood runs down the detainee's left leg. It appears that prisoner was bitten by a German shepherd that is shown snarling at him in other photographs. President Bush is at the Pentagon today to discuss whether these and other new photos should be made public. Well, joining us on the line from the Pentagon is Vince Crawley, defense reporter for the Army Times. Vince, we should say right away that President Bush's visit to the Pentagon was a previously scheduled event before the Abu Ghraib crisis emerged, but of course it has now taken center stage. How much damage control is President Bush doing today?
Certainly a great deal. He just finished speaking, so I was trying to overhear it. It's certainly a great attempt to let folks know that he has no intention of letting this Secretary of Defense go in the midst of battle, as he puts it.
Yeah, and President Bush went on to say that the abuse has caused harm well beyond the walls of the prison. What else did he say that you could hear?
I had to pull away from the woman to deal with this.
Well, in your lead editorial today, the military newspaper, the Army Times, writes that the damage has run straight to the top. Is the Army Times calling for Rumsfeld to resign?
They've stopped short of it, and I'll first say I don't write the editorials. My bosses do that. I'm just one of the reporters trying to make the sense of the world. But, they have said that it was not just a failure of leadership at the local command level. It was a failure that ran straight to the top, and they're just, the editors are saying, let's be accountable if there are the people who set the conditions on the ground for something like this.
Right. They're saying on the battlefield, Rumsfeld's and others' errors would be called a lack of situational awareness, a failure that amounts to professional negligence.
Yes.
What are you hearing in the halls of the Pentagon?
I would say people are still almost in a stunned state. There has always been an undercurrent of officials, low and mid-level, who are not, who have not agreed with the way the war has been prosecuted. And certainly you hear more from them of more I told you so's. But so far it's just kind of this, a lot of disbelief still. I can't believe that something of this scale and gravity has taken place, and they can, you can watch the whole mission unraveling before your eyes, or the potential for it.
Yeah. Vince, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Vince Crawley is defense reporter for the Army Times. He spoke to us from the Pentagon. Well, unlike the Army Times editorial, New York Times conservative op-ed columnist William Safire writes today that Donald Rumsfeld should stay in office. The scandal dominated the weekend talk shows. On NBC's Meet the Press, it pitted the powerful chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John Warner, against freshman Republican Lindsey Graham, who had this to say when told that only Congress would see even more damaging photos.
The allegations in this report involve rape and murder. Please don't leave this whole scenario thinking that this is just about a humiliating experience. This is about system failure. This is about felony offenses. And if there's more to come, let's get it out as a nation, work through it, and show the world that Republicans and Democrats may disagree on the policy and the war in Iraq, but we have the ability to make sure those accountable are going to be held accountable.
Well, joining us on the line is John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Great to be here.
And David Yepsen, political editor of the Des Moines Register in Iowa. Hi, David.
Good to be with you.
And John, to you first. What is the latest Washington talk about resignations, the R word? I referred to William Safire, who says that Donald Rumsfeld should shoulder on.
It's clear, Robin, that the administration is not inclined to get rid of Rumsfeld, and Rumsfeld is not inclined to leave. The president tends to dig in to behind the members of his cabinet so long as they have not been disloyal to him. But, of course, these sort of circumstances take on a dynamic of their own, and the drumbeat didn't go away over the weekend. We'll have to see what happens when those worse images that Don Rumsfeld and Lindsey Graham were talking about emerge to see how viable his continuing in office is going to be.
Well, David, one of the images came out today, the picture of the naked Iraqi detainee recoiling from the U.S. forces' attack dogs. What about what seems to be the dissension in the Republican ranks? Will the heat really increase under Donald Rumsfeld if more Republican voices are raised along with Democrat voices?
I think it could. I can tell you that
people out here are talking about this. You hear people in cafes and coffee shops and on the street talking about this, shaking their head. This isn't just another Washington inside the Beltway scandal. This has resonance outside. And I think it causes the biggest problem it causes for Republicans and the president politically is that it distracts from some other otherwise very good economic news. We had a great week in the American economy last week, and most of those stories were buried well inside of most newspapers and inside of most broadcasts because everyone is fixated on this.
Right. Unemployment went down, which was starting to look like a trend to some. But, John, back to you. How is all of this being reflected in the polls, or is it?
We had a poll, NBC Wall Street Journal poll last week, that was conducted at sort of the dawning of the scandal, and it showed that 60% of the American people now think the U.S. is no longer in control of the situation in Iraq, and that's the real danger for George W. Bush.
Well, David Yepsen, as you say, you're out there in Iowa. How about the arguments for instance, keeping some of the photos private? How are they resonating? Some are saying that to show them, and we heard Armed Services Committee Chair Senator John Warner say the Pentagon will give lawmakers these even more damaging photos to look at in private. And some of the reasoning seems to be that it will protect soldiers overseas. I mean, the more these pictures are seen, some worry that we might see a photo with an American hostage in the same situation.
Well, we're already in that situation. When you're in the middle of a political firestorm like this, you cut your losses. And Lindsey Graham is right. You disclose. You get it all out there. And so I think it would be very difficult to take the Warner position for very long without a real outcry from people over getting this information out. John's right. I mean, we're in the early stages of this, and the polling is starting to add up against Bush. And the longer this goes on, the more damage it is to President Bush, with the most important people in the American electorate, which is about 10 or 15% of the undecided voters in about 15 battleground states. That's what this is all about. And those people need to be focused on the economy and the war getting better, not on what other shoe is yet to drop.
And, Robin, it's interesting that over the weekend, John Zogby, an independent pollster, used to poll for Republican candidates, now does for news organizations, put out an analysis saying that this is John Kerry's election to lose, in part because of one of the factors that David mentioned, which is that the good economic news is getting buried by this story. So that is just another sign of how problematic this is for the administration.
How do you see Kerry responding to this?
Well, John Kerry kept a low profile initially. You know, this is one of those stories that is much, much bigger than a political campaign, and a candidate can look like he's being opportunistic by jumping into it. But he did, as last week wore on, weigh in, said that the administration response had been slow, had been inappropriate. He did call for Don Rumsfeld's resignation. And most importantly, he used this to make a leadership contrast with George W. Bush. One of the biggest assets that Bush has in this election is the perception by the American people that he's a strong leader who acts decisively. And John Kerry tried to, in effect, sully that credential by standing up and saying, I'm not going to be like George Bush. I'm going to be accountable. I'm going to be responsible for what happens on my watch, and I'll act more forcefully in a situation like this than the president has.
David Yepsen again in Iowa. Others are weighing in as well. I'm thinking of columnist George Will, who wrote last week that this administration cannot be trusted to govern if it cannot be counted on to think, and having thought, to have second thoughts. What do you think about conservative reaction to the president's policies, and do you agree with what George Will is saying?
Well, there are a lot of conservatives who had reservations about this war from the very beginning. I mean, we don't hear much of that, but that said, I don't think conservatives are going to be deserting President Bush in the election for John Kerry. If anything, you hear Democrats complaining privately that John Kerry is not doing enough to capitalize on this situation.
And Robin, from the other side, getting back to the original question about whether Don Rumsfeld can stay and survive in this job, this has become somewhat of a test by some elements of the conservative wing of the Republican Party of how resolute George W. Bush is going to be. And they're standing up and saying, stand firm against this onslaught from liberal Democrats and from some of the news media. Keep Don Rumsfeld in his job. Don't back down. We've got to see how the president negotiates that tricky terrain there.
Well, David Yepsen, John Harwood, I want to thank you both.
My pleasure.
David Yepsen, political editor of the Des Moines Register in Iowa. John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Funeral services were held today for the assassinated president of Chechnya. President Ahmed Kadyrov was killed yesterday when a bomb exploded underneath the grandstand he was sitting in. The explosion took place during a celebration of the anniversary of Russia's victory over the Nazis. Sounds from yesterday's bombing at a stadium in Chechnya. In addition to the president, five others were killed in the explosion. Russia's top military man in charge of operations against Chechen rebels, who was seated next to the president, was seriously injured. Joining us from Moscow is Gideon Litchfield, correspondent for The Economist magazine. And Gideon, has anyone claimed responsibility for the bombing? And if we don't know that, why would someone want to kill this president?
Well, nobody's claimed responsibility. One of the main rebel leaders, Aslan Maskhadov, who's more moderate, has denied responsibility, and suspicion is focusing on another leader, Shamil Basayev, who is more radical and who is known to be a sworn enemy of Ahmad Kadyrov.
Well, this was a well-publicized event, as you mentioned. This was Moscow's man in Chechnya. Why wasn't there heavier security? How could a bomb be planted under the VIP seats?
Well, that's a very good question. It's not the first time that terrorists have managed to strike right at the heart of Russian power. It seems as if the bomb was actually built into the podium where Kadyrov was sitting quite a while before the ceremony took place.
Yes, during renovations that were held months ago. Well, Ahmad Kadyrov was not a popular man, but we understand he was getting credit for bringing stability to the region.
That's right. I mean, certainly he wasn't at all popular. The way he ran things was a reign of terror. He had a militia of about 2,000 ex-criminals and ex-soldiers and so on who were enforcing his rule by kidnapping and killing. Nonetheless, there was this increase in stability, and people who've been down to Grozny in the last few months say that you can see little signs that people's lives were just beginning to return to normal. And people, whatever they thought of Kadyrov, they thought that he was probably the closest thing to a sign of stability and a guarantee of some stability that they'd had in years.
And now, besides being an embarrassment for Mr. Putin, what happens now? Is there expected to be new strikes by rebels or a brutal response from the Russian army?
Well, when there have been cases like strong attacks in the past, there haven't necessarily been a series of attacks as a result. A lot of these strikes seem to be isolated. As to the response, again, when there have been attacks in the past, there have been crackdowns. Particularly Chechens in Moscow tend to get a very harsh time from the police. And there are raids and sweeps and so on, searches in Chechnya itself, but nothing really seems to make a difference. Russia has been trying to bring Chechnya under control for years and it hasn't succeeded, so it doesn't seem like there's anything new that they can do.
Gideon, thank you.
Thank you.
Gideon Litchfield, a reporter for The Economist magazine. He spoke to us from Moscow. Just ahead, an experiment from the 70s sheds light on what happened at the Abu Ghraib prison. We'll speak to the man who directed that landmark study. And later, the Tupperware Empire. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The latest shocking image out of the Abu Ghraib prison of a naked Iraqi detainee recoiling from a leashed attack dog is raising questions being asked around the world. How could one individual treat another with such savagery? Well, one person who was not surprised by the images is Stanford University professor Philip Zimbardo. In 1971, he published the results of a landmark experiment about the relationship between prisoners and their guards. And he joins us now. Welcome, Dr. Zimbardo.
Welcome, Robin.
First, can you start by telling us briefly about the study? Who was involved?
Simply, we sought to find the answer to the question, what happens when you put good boys, good men, in an evil place, namely a prison-like environment? To do that, I put an ad in the city newspaper. College students wanted for a study of prison life, 2 weeks, $15 a day. We got about 100 replies. We picked two dozen who were the most normal, most healthy, who had no history of crime or psychopathology, because we wanted to start our prison, if you will, only with good apples, and we're going to put them in a bad barrel and see, does the barrel corrupt them, or do the good people come out the other side the way they went in?
Well, tell us about the barrel. What would you put them in?
Well, the barrel is a simulated prison with bars on the prison cells, solitary confinement, no windows, no clocks. It was cramped quarters with three inmates tightly packed into each of three cells. We put them in a place where we could observe the gradual process of transformation.
And what was that transformation? What happened?
On the morning of the second day, the prisoners rebelled. They didn't like the way they were being treated. They thought they were going to come in and play their guitars and read books. And the little bit that the guards did, the prisoners thought was too extreme. Well, the prisoners locked themselves in their cell, barricaded themselves in, started cursing the guards, which was their big mistake. And the guards on that shift called all the other guards in, and they smashed the rebellion with physical force, using fire extinguishers that sprayed bone-chilling carbon dioxide on them, then stripped them all naked, put the leaders in solitary confinement, made everything a privilege, eating everything but air. From that moment on, the guard said, these are dangerous prisoners. And that was a dramatic first step in this dramatic transformation.
Do we understand that it got so bad that at one point, I mean, this is in a short period of time, that at one point the so-called prisoners were actually forced to simulate sexual activities?
Well, that happened at the end. What's really important for your listeners to realize is that this is a gradual process of transformation. But in the Abu Ghraib prison, the images we're seeing were not the images of day one, not even the images of day six. There is a gradual transformation from your ordinary state into this, if you will, monster state.
Mm-hmm.
The guards started by having prisoners do menial tasks, having them clean out toilet bowls with their bare hands, humiliating them, degrading them. So each day was a kind of platform on which they built the creative evil of the next day.
It sounds as if, in your case, and maybe this is a parallel that you see with Abu Ghraib, both of the sides started to see themselves as prisoners of the situation.
The sad thing is that guards, in fact, are prisoners of this institution. That is, society, in a sense, has really no respect for prisons. Prison is a place where you dump people. We don't want to know what happens in prisons. And in fact, a lot of the abuse in the Abu Ghraib prison takes place in prisons throughout the world, because prisons are places cloaked in a veil of secrecy. That means no one knows what goes on in a prison, and you know what? No one really cares.
You had to stop your experiment because, as you said, it got so grotesque at a certain point. But when you heard these reports come out of Abu Ghraib, what was your first thought?
Yeah, so we ended our study. I ended this two-week study after 6 days when we started to see the sexual degradation. Most of it took place in the middle of the night when I was asleep. And it's only when we looked at videos the next day, we said, oh, my God, what's going on here? What went on there was the guards were bored, as the guards are in most prisons, and the prisoners were their playthings. So in one sense, it was fun and games to the guard. They began to redefine the situation and what they were doing. They didn't see it as evil. They just thought it's fun and games. It's a little more extreme than fraternity hazing, than army boot camp.
Sounds like a lot more extreme.
Well, it starts off a little bit, and it gets more and more. But see, because it's gradual, you don't notice it, because each day is only a little worse than the previous day.
Well, Professor, I know a lot of people are going to be digging up your study as we have been, but do you have one thing to offer in light of Abu Ghraib? How can this be changed? Large numbers of detainees often have to be kept in one place.
The point of all this is the guards have to be trained to acknowledge or realize the enormous power they have. The most critical thing about prison, aside from their secrecy, is the enormous power differential. So guards have to be trained to be on guard against the sadistic impulse that comes with that role.
Mm.
Therefore, you need strict rules. You need accountability. There can't be secrecy. You need strong leadership. What you had in Abu Ghraib is no leadership, little training of the guards. I think this event, the only good that can come out of it is, for prison officials in prisons throughout the world, and starting with the military, to realize how vulnerable those situations are for abuse.
Mm-hmm.
The second critical thing that I have to get across is the president, all the generals, Rumsfeld, are saying we got to get to the bottom of this. We got to get rid of these few bad apples in the barrel. I'm saying the parallel is it's the barrel that's evil, and not the people who are in it. They're guilty, and they'll be punished. But I'm saying they're guilty, but they're not to blame. the person to blame is the people who created that barrel and then filled it with the vinegar of all the things that go with war. And so I hate to see these soldiers whose lives are ruined from this, clearly, as well as the poor, you know, Iraqi prisoners who were, again, citizens, young men who hadn't done anything, just like the prisoners in my study. They were all waiting. They were in pre-trial detention. I think we have to get to the top of this rather than, as the president said, let's get to the bottom of this. Because it really starts with the commander-in-chief. It goes to Rumsfeld, goes to Wolfowitz, generals who really try to cover this up.
Philip Zimbardo, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Philip Zimbardo, professor of psychology at Stanford University. For more on his study, go to our website, here-now.org. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us your town and how to pronounce your full name. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Army's 912th Forward Surgical Team has been serving in Iraq longer than any other forward surgical team. They were first deployed in February of 2003. They've had their stay in Iraq extended twice. WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum spoke with members of the 912th and their families, and she joins us now in the studio. Rachel, welcome.
Hi there.
And tell us, what is a forward surgical team?
Well, these are specialized units that were created after the Gulf War to replace MASH units. They are soldiers who go to the front lines with those in battle. They set up in tents. They set up in buildings. They do surgery. The idea is something called the golden hour of trauma. If you can get to a wounded soldier within an hour, they have a much better survivability.
Right. So they're right up front for that reason. Well, you talked to one woman whose husband is a surgical technician with the 912th. Tell us more about her thoughts.
Well, her husband's been away for 15 months, and her, you know, she's suffering, and her children are suffering as well. She says that her son is angry and that her daughter, who was outgoing, is now shy and can't be away from her mother. Neither of them can.
There were times I would drop her off at school and it would take three teachers to pry her off of me because she was freaking out. She didn't want me to leave. Michael, if we go to a store, he always stays. Like, if I go to the store, like the kids and I and my mom, he always stays right there with me. He'll never go off with my mom because he thinks I'm going to leave. They feel they lost one parent, and they're afraid that they're going to lose the other one.
The wife of a surgical technician with the Army's 912th Forward Surgical Team. Rachel, I understand that there is one member of the unit who is home now, the reverse situation, and you spoke to him.
Yeah, Joe Stevens came back because of his wife's postpartum depression, and he was a medic there. And at home here, he is and was a surgical technician in an operating room. And he said he's having flashbacks. He had flashbacks during surgery and couldn't do it anymore, couldn't stand the smell of blood because he's reminded. And now he's a prison guard, but he's haunted by what happened in Iraq. This is one memory that he keeps having here.
A Chinook had gotten shot out of the sky by an RPG. And when this Chinook went down, you know, they took patients everywhere. And like 40-something or 50-something odd patients, you know, on a I think out of all of them, I maybe like 8 lived, you know. And this guy was 19 years old. But when he got to us, he wasn't there. He was out of it. He was dead. It's like, here I am. I'm in Iraq. I'm holding some mother's child in my hand, you know. And that mother has no idea that her son is dead.
I just want to add that, the 912 FST has been there the longest, and they could be extended again because reservists, they are reservists, can serve up to 2 years.
WBUR reporter Rachel Gottbaum spoke to members and families of the Army's 912th Forward Surgical Team, or FST. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Well, last Thursday, I found myself on a flight from Athens, Greece, to New York, along with 60 returning American soldiers, including 42-year-old Robert Thomas, a career Army medic who'd served 5 times in combat, including the last 4 months at a base outside of Tikrit, Iraq. Robert didn't want to name his unit, and he didn't want to talk about any of the recent news from Abu Ghraib prison. But he did desperately want people to know about the good that American soldiers are doing. He was recently in a convoy that came under attack. He's bringing home a few pieces of still-embedded shrapnel and a wariness about how Americans will greet him.
They pulled shrapnel from me. Still have some in me, but we're still able to drive on. When the time came to do what they, as I say, children, in my eyes, 18, 19, 20 years old, had to do, they did their job, and they did it very well. They're not professional soldiers by trade. Most of them are in college. I happen to be a professional soldier. I'm 42. So having these children, in my eyes, step up and do the job, they've done a wonderful job. And everybody in the States needs to know that they need to feel comfortable about what these kids are doing.
We've been talking a little bit here on the flight as you make your way home on leave. Tell me if I'm characterizing this right. You felt a little defensive to me, like you were anticipating that the soldiers aren't appreciated. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah. And the reason I say that, some of the newspapers I get from home, which my wife sends me, I believe any time that there's any military in harm's way, any time, these kids and us older guys are out there defending our rights, defending our beliefs, and defending against terrorism. That should be front page news. I don't care if a soldier gets a scratch. The American people should know that. And that's up to the media to make sure that's out.
And you feel that hasn't been reported?
Absolutely. These soldiers are doing a wonderful job. I mean, nobody hears the good things that they're doing. I mean, they're doing schools, doing community work. The engineers are out there building roads, building houses, and different things. And even the civilian contractors, the American civilian contractors, out there doing their job.
Tell me more about that country. What was it like? Did you have interactions with Iraqis? Did you see things that soldiers were doing? And tell us a little more about that.
Some of my upper bosses like to take me out as protection with them to go out into the villages and stuff. And, you know, these people, they love to see us, especially the children. But it's kind of strange when you go into these neighborhoods, kids are just running loose all over the place. I mean, from the time they can walk until, especially with little girls, up until about 12 or 13. And then they're pulled into the house and you never see them again until they're women. Women don't have very many rights over here, which is kind of sad, you know. I remember I wanted to take one picture with this little girl and her brother and this older boy, another family. He wanted to get into pictures. And no, I wanted these two. And he literally hit this girl, smacked her around, and sent her home, which really upset me. I mean, I had something to say, but I also had to remember it's not our culture, and we had to leave it alone. It's kind of hurt, really hurt, but we had to let it go.
How do you feel about heading home?
Well, the only one that knows I'm coming home is my wife. I'm heading home because my twin girls graduate high school, and it brings quite a tear to my eye because education is everything to me. And quite a surprise coming home for Mother's Day for Mom, especially after losing my dad in Vietnam. Mom's happy. Mom will be happy. Sorry.
No apology needed. Medic Robert Thomas on leave from Iraq on his way home to Florida last week for Mother's Day. You're listening to Here and Now. It will be official tonight. After months of rancorous debate, the city of Zephyr Hills, Florida, will vote to change the name of Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue back to 6th Avenue. At the request of a local resident, Irene Dobson, the city council voted last October to name the street for Dr. King. But other residents, mostly white, objected, and after debate, petitions, and protests, the decision was reversed. Well, Irene Dobson joins us now from Zephyr Hills, which is about 45 minutes north of Tampa. Hello, Mrs. Dobson.
Hello.
Well, and I understand that you got the city of Zephyr Hills to rename 6th Avenue to Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, and, you know, now they are changing it back.
Yes, changing it back because they, you know, they don't want MLK, so they want us to, you know, do a compromise. So they say.
Yeah, well, they're saying that they might name a planned water park or a new library for Dr. King instead of the street.
Well, don't even put that on the news because they don't have nothing built and we won't even go there.
Yeah. Well, you know, some people are saying that this is racism on the part of the people.
Racism is all it is.
Why do you think that?
Lord Jesus, here I go. Hmm. Why do I think that?
Yeah.
Because from the time that we, you know, started this, they don't want no black person naming on the street where they got to live. They say that it would bring down the property value, which that's not right. Mm-hmm. And on 6th Avenue, there's no businesses on that street at all. It's a residential street.
There are others, though, who say that this is something they weren't consulted on, that they don't want to go through the bother of changing their addresses and changing their envelopes, and they just
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
How long have you lived where you're living? Did you ever have to move?
Oh, several times.
Well, didn't you have to change your address and your checkbook number and all that good stuff?
Yeah.
The same thing here. You're not that dumb.
You mean you think it's easier, it's far easier for people to do, and that's just something they're saying?
That's something they're saying.
You're 80 years old. What are you going to do now?
I'm going to sit quiet.
You're not going to fight this?
You never let the left hand know what the right hand is doing, okay?
Will you protest this? Will you?
Well, we've been doing that all the week, sweetheart.
Yeah.
We've been doing standing down there in front of City Hall and on 301, you know, with picket signs up. No, is there, one thing, there's been no violence at all. You know, everything was done peaceful.
Yeah. What would you want to tell the largely white residents of Zephyr Hills, how this makes you feel that this street is obviously going to have its name changed back from Dr. King to 6th Avenue?
Well, basically, they know how it makes me feel because everybody know me. I've been here and I've been around. I'm a people person. I've never had any problems or anything with the kids going to school or anything. We never had this kind of problem with, you know, something like this. And so I spoke up and thought everything was going through, but come to City Hall and they, brother, I knew, right, you know, I knew then that Zephyr Hills wasn't what it was supposed to be. A quiet little tourist town where practically everybody knew everybody and we got along. And, you know, when that went to the city council meeting and they came, you know, it came up, then all the rednecks come out the woodworks because it's not that many live on 6th Avenue.
Well, Irene Dobson, I want to thank you for talking to us.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Irene Dobson, a resident of Zephyr Hills, Florida. She lives about one block from what will soon be called 6th Avenue. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Tupperware, those little plastic bowls that burp, have famously been keeping food fresh for decades. But the woman responsible for their fame is less of a household name. Before setting her sights on Tupperware, Brownie Wise, then a recently divorced homemaker, made ends meet by organizing sales parties for Stanley Home Products. In 1951, she took her ambitious home party ideas to Tupperware's inventor, Earl Tupper, and the company took off. Tupperware was burping, and Tupperware mania was exploding as Brownie's loyal sales force of housewives charged into living rooms across the country.
I was looking for something to do to earn some money, because on a farm, I wanted this blonde coffee table, and that is just not on the list. So I went to that party, and she said, I made $10 here today. There wasn't anything that I could have done and worked all day at that time in the panhandle and have made $10. So I was thinking, gosh, if I could just make $5, 10 parties down the road, I could have that blonde coffee table.
The story of Tupperware ladies, as they were called, and the rise and fall of Brownie Wise is being told tonight on PBS in the documentary Tupperware. And filmmaker Laurie Kahn-Levitt joins us in the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
This film, it's so, first of all, it's so in the period. I was watching it and seeing those cinched waists on the dresses that flare out and the women with the heels while they vacuumed. It was in the time when Rosie the Riveter was told, thank you very much for taking the jobs of the men while they had to go to work, but now you have to go home.
Completely. These are women who came from working class backgrounds, by and large, and they needed extra income, but the culture was telling them, get back to the kitchen. Here was something that they could do part-time, they could stay at home, do it out of their houses, and control their own hours.
Well, and it was born of necessity. Brownie Wise was one of those women, and she literally called up a Mr. Tupper and told him what?
Well, Brownie Wise never got past eighth grade. Here's a woman who grew up very poor in Georgia, had moved to Detroit when she got married, was divorced and single. When she gets into Stanley Home Products, then starts saying, wow, I should sell Tupperware at home parties. And her orders are late all the time. So very Brownie, very sort of decisive. She calls the factory to complain that her order's late again and says, and I insist on speaking to Mr. Tupper himself. So Earl gets on the phone and she chews him out. And he says, what are you doing? You are selling more than all the department stores. And she said, home parties. He was a guy who hated the limelight, was very reclusive. And when he first met Brownie, he was completely wowed by her. And he handed her the entire sales and marketing operation of his company. And he sets her up in Florida to do all of the sales operations while he continues designing it and manufacturing it in New England. So it's these two really different interconnected cultures of the buttoned up, sort of repressed engineer perfectionist up in New England. And then this exuberant, over-the-top, anything-goes culture in Florida. It's a really interesting combination.
We know you stumbled on this story when you were researching the history of plastics and came across letters between Mr. Tupper and Brownie Wise, and also archival footage. We have some that we want to listen to of one of the marketing devices. They had the women who were the sales force come down and dig. What were they doing, digging in the ground?
Every year, Brownie had this thing called the Tupperware Jubilee. And this was a four-day extravaganza to reward and motivate and teach her sales force. So the very first one in 1954 was the Gold Rush, was the theme. And what they did is they had prizes for the top salespeople, you know, 600 of them. And they buried them, of course, in Tupperware containers, in the dirt in front of Tupperware headquarters, put a shovel on top of each of the prizes, right? And then say to the women, okay, go. And all these women go rushing out, grab a shovel and dig. And what do they have? Diamond rings, mink coats, whatever.
600 shovels on an acre of ground. And do we have fun? Watches, diamond rings, mink coats, television sets. We really strike gold.
I was so excited. I got on that shovel and I dug up that dirt and I hit a box and I pulled the box out of the ground, opened it up, and it was a double boiler, an Echo cookware. And I still have that. From all those years, I just saved that little double boiler with a cover. I thought it was wonderful.
I don't think we're giving anything away by asking you, what's the end of the story of Brownie Wise and Tupperware?
Brownie Wise built an empire for this man, Earl Silas Tupper, and they had this very cozy relationship at first, then a very business-like relationship, but she was in the press. She was everywhere. She was the first woman ever on the cover of Business Week. She was in Life. She was in Time. She was in all the women's magazines. And the press started to give her all of the credit for the success of the company. And Earl didn't want the limelight for himself, but he wanted it for his product, and it ate him alive. Add to that that the company was growing exponentially, and larger companies started to circle and offer Earl money to buy him out. And a couple of those people said, we'll buy it, but we're only going to buy it if there's not a woman at the top.
Even though she was the force behind it.
Yep. Things got very tense. I mean, if you are in the archives and you're reading through the correspondence between these two, there's a lot of, you know, sort of matter-of-fact correspondence through the 50s after the initial, you know, very infatuated phase. And then this explosion of correspondence between the two of them where he's writing these sharp little memos, you know, why did you do this and why did you do that? And it just spins out of control and the two of them just, it implodes. When Earl Tupper fired her, and he never went to Jubilees, he never went to Florida. So here he is, he shows up. He has all of Brownie's photographs pulled out of the files and burned. And the people who took over talked her into writing a letter to her entire sales force saying that she was choosing to retire. And then Brownie starts another company, Cinderella Cosmetics, and tries to woo her sales force over to her. And the company deals with it brilliantly. I mean, brilliantly. The people who take over, she puts a full-page ad in the paper to woo them to her new company. And instead of hiding it or sort of not talking about it, they go down to the paper. They buy 2,000 copies of this paper, put it on everybody's seat at Jubilee, and say, open it up. Take a look. Brownie's inviting you. We understand Brownie means a lot to you, but we think this is a very bad choice. You've done very well in Tupperware. You know what you've been able to do for your families. You've bought a car or a house. You've put your kids through college. But if you want to go, please get up.
Is Brownie Wise's story a tragic story?
In a sort of classic Shakespearean sense, she also had some very important tragic flaws. I mean, she and Earl Tupper were both very ambitious but incomplete. And it's like they bumped into each other and took off beyond their wildest dreams, but couldn't see that they needed each other.
And now her story is going to be told in a feature film because of the documentary you've made. Who should play Brownie Wise?
That's a really hard one. Earl Tupper's easier. I think Ed Harris would be a great Earl Tupper. He's both charming and can be really abrasive. Brownie's a tough one because there's something sort of antique about Brownie. She really does belong to a different era. And I've got four or five possible ideas, but it'll ultimately be the director's choice who plays her. But it's someone who is Southern, who is unbelievably charismatic, but at some level fragile.
Charlize Theron.
Maybe. You know, I think that Annette Bening would be pretty amazing in the role. Laura Dern, possibly.
Hmm. And did you ever think that it would come this far?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew I was sitting on a great story. I mean, I was going to do this cultural history of plastics, you know, from celluloid to polar fleece, which would be fun. But when I came across the papers of Earl Tupper and the papers of Brownie Wise and a few of these early Jubilee films, the rest of them I found in people's attics and basements and in, you know, the company's loft where they had outtakes they didn't even know they had from 50 years ago. And I knew it could be a good feature film. But when I went out with the documentary and was at film festivals, not one, not two, but like three different studios approached me and said, what a story.
Well, Laurie Conn-Levitt, thanks for talking to us and good luck with it.
Thanks very much.
Laurie Conn-Levitt's film Tupperware airs on the American Experience tonight. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org.
They read the cookbook from Friday till Monday. That's how the weekend goes. I've got a dream house, I'll build there one day with picket fence and rambling road.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Laughing like a clown. I love those dear.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.